Right now, let's speak to a gentleman who I have been waiting weeks to speak to. His name is Avi Yorich. How are you, Avi?
Such a pleasure to be back on the show, Kathy. Thanks for having me back on.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. I've been listening to your reports every week. I just haven't had the opportunity to speak to you. And I just want to tell our listeners very quickly about you. Avi Yorich, he's a seasoned entrepreneur. He's a Middle East expert. He's a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. He's a founder of a business called IMS, which is a merchant processing company. He's a thought leader in exploring global innovations. He's also a thought leader in the Arab world, counterterrorism, illicit finance. His CV is actually just too long for one introduction, but it gives me tremendous pleasure to speak to him. He's written 5 books. One of them is on Iran. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of research and experience that went into that. And so we thought, you know, let's find out. You know, Iran today is the number one funder of global terrorism. Avi, what is the end game for Iran? What does Iran actually want?
So let's boil it down for your listeners. Ultimately, what both radical Sunnis and radical Shias want are Islamic republics around the world. And when I mean an Islamic republic, it's a state based on Islamic Sharia law. Now, we have a number of Islamic republics in the world today. Iran is the only Shia variety. We have Saudi Arabia, the northern part of Nigeria. Afghanistan was an Islamic republic until the United States invaded in 2003. We have a number of Islamic republics around the world, and both Sunnis and Shia want Islamic republics. The Shia, which is of the variety that Iran is of, they want to build something what I like to call a mullahtocracy. So where there are Shia around the world in places like Lebanon, Bahrain, Yemen, you will see Iran funding to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars organizations that see the world in the same way and that also want to build Islamic republics. The same thing holds true with radical Sunni organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They're slightly different in that they want to have the Muslim world united by a caliphate, you know, a pope-like figure, whereas the Shia world really is this theocracy of mullahs. They're related but separate. That is the end game. And ultimately, interestingly, it's why 9/11 took place back in 2001. The likes of Osama bin Laden believed that the only way to create Islamic republics in the Muslim world was to force the great military powers of the world, in this case the United States, to stop propping up dictatorships in the Muslim world. And ultimately, that is why the attack took place on 9/11.
Is that not linked to Islamic outlook that, you know, the world to come will manifest when you create chaos? Isn't there something in Islam like that?
Well, there's plenty of schools of thought in that regard. That's only one of many. There are certainly many, many strands of Islam, and we shouldn't confuse Islam with radical Islam. There are 1.4 billion Muslims on the planet.
Yeah.
Far from all of them are radical. Many, the vast majority, I would say, are peace-seeking people that view the world in a harmonious, peaceful way, but we do have radical Muslims that espouse a very violent form of Islam, and those are the ones that I'm focused on today.
Right. Why the obsession with Israel? What's in it
for
them?
That's a very good question. So first of all, it's Israel is in the heart of the Muslim world. Organizations like, let's start with Iran. Why does Iran care so much about Israel? I actually tend to think that in Iran's view, Israel is a foil. If you focus on that conflict, it truly allows them to fund organizations that they care about while the rest of the Arab/Muslim world turns a blind eye. So let's take, for example, Hezbollah. They fund Hezbollah to the tune of about $500 million a year, and Hezbollah has amassed 100 to 150,000 rockets on the northern border of Israel. And Iran has been able to fund the organization, and that is where the world's attention is focused on, and rightfully so. But that is not where Iran's focus is at. They're ultimately funding Hezbollah with the goal of creating this Islamic Republic, of having a vice grip over the country, and ultimately taking over. The same thing is true in Iraq, the same thing is true in Bahrain, and the same thing is true in Yemen. And the goal of Iran today is hegemony in the Muslim world of those individuals that are of the Shia faith. And so Iran is concerned with Israel in an effort to have global dominance, but not ultimately because they really care about Israel. Now, the Sunni world is a little different. Organizations like Hamas, which are on Israel's southwestern border in Gaza, obviously they have taken over the Gaza Strip. They've been there for about 10 years. They ultimately have an eye to destroy the state of Israel. Their charter calls for throwing all the Jews into the sea, or at the very least, removing them from the country. This is a very violent takeover of the country. They are truly here for a one-state solution.
So interesting. Avi, I was speaking to a Muslim friend of mine, and he and I have very frank discussions about, you know, the two different faiths. And he was actually saying to me, he said, Kathy, you don't realize that before 1948, Islam was actually on the decline globally. I mean, if you think about Lebanon and the tourist trade, what was happening in the Arab countries, there was none of the stringencies that there are today. I mean, that was really contained to a minority. So it's interesting that the establishment of the state of Israel, he said to me, like, overnight, there was this regeneration of Islam.
Well, I would say that is true. The radical fringes of Islam managed to leverage successfully the establishment of the state of Israel for their means. They whipped up anti-Israel sentiments in an effort to gather power, gather money, gather influence. And I would say we're seeing the fruits of their labor today. Look at a place like Turkey, which over the course of the last 10 years has become far more radical. A country like Egypt that I lived in for a few years, from 2011 to 2013, they were ruled by the Muslim Brotherhood, and then the tide turned, and you have the General Sisi today, who's in power, who is secular and who's cracking down on radical fringes of Egyptian separatist movements. So we are seeing the Muslim world writ large turning more towards a stricter version of Islam. But I for one am hopeful over the course of the long haul. If you look back in history, if you look back in the 1980s, or even before the 1980s, everyone was really looking at Eastern Europe as a backward, behind the Iron Curtain part of the world. And starting in 1989, we really became much, much more hopeful. And you look at Eastern Europe today, and no one, if you look back 40 years, no one would have predicted that Eastern Europe today would become this thriving economic habitat. I tend to think that I don't know when that period will come, but ultimately technology has a way of improving the lives of many, many, many people. If you look at a place today in the Arab world like Dubai, Dubai is a thriving economic powerhouse. It is diversifying its reliance on oil and gas and bringing in technology and banking and a whole host of other fields in order to really diversify the way people earn and make money. And ultimately, that is where the hope lies. Let's take, for example, a wonderful nonprofit called the Khan Academy, which is an online platform that allows millions of people around the world to learn for free. Bill Gates, for example, uses that platform to teach his children math and science. That today is translated into 20 languages, including Arabic. And ultimately, that is where I think we're going to start seeing this inflection point in history of leveraging the knowledge economy for the benefit of all humanity when it comes to fighting over poverty, when it comes to fighting food security and water security, or I should say fighting on behalf of water security, food security, artificial intelligence. We are at an inflection point in history. In the next 20 to 30 years, the world is going to look radically different. Look, every one of us has a smartphone in their pocket today. We have to remember that was not around 10 years ago. 10 years ago, Steve Jobs created the smartphone. Can you imagine what's going to be in the next 10, 20, 30 years? We are on the brink of some very, very exciting times. And when it comes to Israel, Israel is a place today that I'm extraordinarily hopeful about because it is solving global challenges. It is literally improving the lives of billions of people. And ultimately, I believe that that will spread to the Arab world and to its neighbors. Egypt, we talked about this last week on your show. In 6 years is going to run out of water. That's 100 million people are not going to have water. Iran, a country today that points its missiles at Israel, in 20 years, it's a country of 80 million people, in 20 years, 50% of these individuals are going to run out of water. Israel is the only country in the world to have self-declared become a water superpower. It has more water than it knows what to do with as a result of leveraging technology. And so that trend line holds true when it comes to medicine, agriculture, and water. And so that is why I'm so hopeful about the future of the Middle East and Israel's place in it.
Amazing. Absolutely incredible. Avi Yerush, it is such a privilege to speak to you. And I can see my co-host Simon is jumping up and down. He's got a list of questions.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm just so, I don't know, while I was jotting around India where you made this connection, it's fantastic and I can't wait for more.
So we're going to catch up with you next week. Thank you so much.
Great. Same time, same place. Thanks so much. I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. God bless.